What do we do?
How do we make them better? It's a very good question, and I don't fully have the answer to that. The first point of call is to actually identify that this can actually be a problem for a number of people, and that you sometimes just questioning doctors, questioning healthcare staff. Is there anything we can actually do? Are you still suffering from the effects? Is this something you want to talk about? Is actually the first step towards it. I know it's not a definitive solution, but it allows us to at least bring it into a discussion and allows us to formulate some form of solutions. As you saw from Professor Fong's testimony, how deeply impacting it was for him and for his staff.
Doctor, thank you for speaking to me this evening. Thank you. If you work within the NHS and you recognise this, it would be great to hear from you tonight, 0808 509 693, as we try to build the picture across the NHS, across the UK, with the aftermath of COVID. Many of us are thanking goodness that it's gone, it's behind us, but for some it's not.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
There have been warm tributes to Dame Maggie Smith, who's died at the age of 89. She was best known for her roles in the Harry Potter films and in Downton Abbey, and won two Oscars during a career that spanned seven decades. Hugh Bonneville, who also starred in Downton Abbey, said Dame Maggie was a true legend of her generation. Sir Nicholas Heitner directed her in The Lady in the Van, both on stage and on screen.
In her great performances, you think you've got the measure of her, but you never have. Because she's always ahead of you. She's always taking you somewhere thrilling, strange, interesting and unexpected.
Israel says it's bombed what it called Hezbollah's central headquarters in Beirut. The Lebanese health ministry said the attack killed at least two people and injured 76 others. The attack came shortly after the Israeli prime minister addressed the UN General Assembly in New York. America's top diplomat, Antony Blinken, said it was important for residents of northern Israel displaced by Hezbollah's rockets to be returned to home safely.
The question is, what's the best way to do that? What is the most effective, sustainable way to do that? We believe, many other countries who joined us in putting out a call for a ceasefire for 21 days believe, that the best way to do that is through diplomacy, through a ceasefire and then reaching an agreement.
It's emerged that Sir Keir Starmer received an additional £16,000 worth of clothing from the Labour peer Lord Ali. Initially, the donations were declared as money for his private office as leader of the opposition. Following advice sought by Number 10, they've now been recategorised as donations in kind of clothing. He said he won't accept similar donations in future. Two boys have been sentenced to life with a minimum term of 8.5 years for murdering a teenager with a machete. The pair, who can't be named, were just 12 when they attacked Sean Caesarhigh in a park in Wolverhampton in November last year. They're the UK's youngest knife murderers. Speaking outside Nottingham Crown Court, Chief Superintendent Kim Maddell from West Midlands Police said the crime had been both shocking and saddening.
The impact of knife crime is devastating, no matter where you live in the country. This is an issue that affects us all. Much work has been done and we have had successes in some areas. However, this is clearly not enough.
And the Royal Navy has released 6 rare turtles back into the wild after they washed up on the shores of Anglesey, Cornwall and Devon. Experts say the young loggerhead turtles were swept from the Caribbean or the eastern coast of the US by strong winds and Atlantic currents. After being cared for by a local zoo and aquarium for some months, they were dropped from the HMS Medway into the ocean off the Azores and were seen off by the ship's crew. That's all the latest BBC News. We'll have more in about an hour's time.
Matt Shawley,
BBC Radio 5 Live.
We are looking for a member of Matt's Parliament for New Forest East. Mick has got a claim. Hello, Mick.
In 1997, I proposed in a little hotel. I was actually in the bathroom.
What?
We were getting ready for dinner and I wanted it all to be sort of sorted before we went in and celebrated.
Lisa Nadi, Central State for Culture Media Sport.
We're toughening up the system to make sure that people who are unfit owners can't become football club owners.
Matt Shawley,
Monday to Friday from 2
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Stephen Nolan
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Well, here are some of the stories and voices we've been hearing from on the Nolan Show tonight. Israel's military has ordered people to evacuate certain buildings in the southern Beirut for their safety. Emma Bartholomew is in Beirut now.
This evening was the first time that I personally felt the blast force and certainly heard it. So that's slightly changed the atmosphere where I am, because we obviously know that this was a huge bombardment. The Lebanese people are very well known for their resilience.
The Treasury is reconsidering parts of Labour's manifesto to plan for non-domiciled tax status over worries that the reforms will bring in less money than expected. Dr. Aaron Advani is an economist and director of the Centre for the Analysis of Taxation.
So we did some work on this a couple of years ago, and we said that there was something like £3.5 billion of overseas investment income and capital gains that is potentially taxable, and like, could be taxable in the UK if non-doms didn't have access to the remittance basis and instead were taxed like UK individuals. And that was after accounting for the fact that many of them have some chance of migrating.
And if you worked during the pandemic while in the NHS, we're looking to hear from you tonight. Dr. Paul Ithomenu is a spokesperson and ambassador for Doctors in Distress.
I think because we went from going from a COVID environment to going back to essentially a normal working hospital environment, there's never really been a time where doctors and nurses and healthcare professionals have actually been able to decompress from the events and the trauma that they actually experience. So there is this ongoing burnout which is getting worse.
The headlines tomorrow, the Daily Telegraph, Boris's war cry and COVID invade Holland. The Daily Mirror, National Treasure mourn. The Times, tuition fees to rise, but grants return too. Here's how to get in touch.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Call free 08085 909 693. Text 85058. Text will be charged at your standard message rate. Visit bbc.co.uk/5liveterms for our terms of use and privacy notice. Stephen Nolan
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Thanks for being with us tonight. Victims of stalking are not being protected enough by police forces in England and Wales. A damning report by police chiefs in England and Wales has found in 2022 a coalition of charities led by Susie Lampler Trust submitted a super complaint where systemic failures in policing can be raised. 10 months later, the internal examination has found evidence of the risks of stalking being downplayed and a lack of training and confusion over what constitutes stalking. I've been speaking to Brighton-based campaigner and domestic abuse campaigner Sam Taylor. I started by asking her what she made of this report.
Unfortunately, I'm not surprised, and it's just so disappointing because I started campaigning to change the law for stalking back in 2011. By that point, I'd been stalked for 3 years relentlessly by an extremely dangerous person. So to see this is, I just feel like nothing's changed, which is terrible. I mean, I think things have hopefully changed, but I think there are so many things that have gone backwards in the meantime. So we managed to get the law changed on the 25th of November 2012, and I can see that they've got a deadline to make improvements by the 22nd of November 2024. I suppose
12 years later. Tell me what the fundamentals are highlighted in this report about what's still wrong.
So the police are not understanding stalking, and my God, we did some work to really try and change that. Not just the police, healthcare professionals, courts. Courts are a massive issue here as well, because I know that some police forces or police officers do some really good work in stalking. But, you know, I think there have been some, you know...
And how do they not understand what it is? Like, where is the misunderstanding?
Well, I think from what I can understand from what I've heard from speaking to police officers in the past, and this was covered in the report as well, is they just don't seem to be able to untangle the difference between harassment and stalking. And stalking comes under the Harassment Act. So it just makes it too complicated. And I notice that Claire Waxman, who I campaigned with for years, she has recommended in the report that we absolutely have to have a single standalone stalking offence so that you can understand what stalking is. Because at the end of the day, harassment can be something like a neighbourly dispute, you know, an argument over the height of a hedge or a tree in a garden. And having them under the same legal structure isn't working. It's just not working. Yeah, it's making it too complex. It needs to be
so
absolutely
separate. So can you define stalking?
First of all, I'll give you an experience that I had. I was stalked by the father of my children for 4 years, relentlessly. He had lots of previous criminal convictions that I wasn't aware of. He'd been in prison previously, which I wasn't aware of. This information was disclosed to me when my children were very small. And then I asked him to leave and he wouldn't go. And then one evening he attacked me with a knife and he tried to break my neck, having never previously been physically violent before. And I wasn't afraid of him at all. But one of the issues here is the point of separation. Now, I am talking specifically because this is my experience of an intimate partner relationship. So post-separation, domestic abuse that becomes stalking. He would follow me everywhere. And this is before tracking devices, mobile phones. Well, we had mobile phones, but they were fairly new. He knew he spent every minute of every day because he was absolutely fixated and obsessed about where I was and what I was doing. Because after he assaulted me, he went on the run for 4 days. He was eventually picked up, held in the cells overnight and then released. And then it just went on and on and on like that, and it escalated. I was absolutely terrified for my life. It absolutely needs to be a law on its own. So when I was being stalked, he was making threats via friends, via my workplace. He was turning up at my workplace. He was turning up at my parents' house. He was living in the allotments at the back of my property. He was breaking into my property. He was turning up at my kids' nursery. It just went on and on and on and on. And he'd made serious threats to kill. So I was beside myself.
Can a stalking offence also, rather than obviously, the physical, the literally they are there in front of you, can it also be written down?
Online.
Can you stalk people online?
Absolutely. Oh, my God, yes. So there is from what I understand, looking at the report, there's a whole cyber unit dealing with this. I don't know how big it is and how accessible it is for people nationwide. I really don't. And I don't know how many police officers or courts, for that matter. The courts really are key within this because you can get police officers who get it all the way till you get to the court, and then you've got a judge who doesn't even know what Facebook is, potentially. So, yes, absolutely. If you've got somebody who is absolutely fixated on someone that they are spending every minute of their time, and this is what you've got to look at, is how often and how long a perpetrator is looking at their victim, whether it's from afar or up close or online or whatever. And I read in the report, it says 42% of victims are experiencing online abuse. And online abuse is just as terrifying because you don't know where they are. You don't know if they know where you live or they know where you work or where you are at any time of the day. It's absolutely terrifying. So I think this is it is a really complex area, but it's got to be driven by the people who know what they're talking about. And I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of work out there that's being done which is a bit half-hearted. I mean, for example, just to say that, you know, unfortunately, the police force has been decimated within the last government, in my view. They had money stripped out of them. You've got issues where you've got perpetrators within the police, unfortunately. So, you know, I know people that won't even go to the police for, you know, sometimes for those reasons, sometimes not.
What needs to be done?
The law needs to be an absolute separate offence, and we need to go all guns blazing to get that to happen. And, you know, we need to educate across the board, because educating just police officers isn't going to get us where we need to go. You know, you've got to be educating people in A&E, you've got to be educating schools, and I know this is specifically around the police and a focus on the police, but you've got to have magistrates and judges to understand what they're dealing with as well. So you've got to have all the people round the table to really unpick what needs to happen here. Yeah, and it's going to inevitably these things are going to take money, investment.
Thank you very much indeed, Sam, for spelling it out to us tonight. Thank you.
No worries. Cheers.
Now, next to Lebanon, Israel says it's bombed what it called Hezbollah's central headquarters in Beirut as part of a series of targeted strikes. The Lebanese health ministry said the attack killed at least 2 people and injured 76 others. The attacks came less than an hour after Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told the United Nations General Assembly in New York that his country was fighting for its life and that the offensive against Hezbollah would not end until Israel's objectives had been met.
I didn't intend to come here this year. My country is at war, fighting for its life. But after I heard the lies and slanders leveled at my country by many of the speakers at this podium, I decided to come here and set the record straight. We face savage enemies who seek our annihilation, and we must defend ourselves against these savage murderers. Our enemies seek not only to destroy us, they seek to destroy our common civilization and return all of us to a dark age of tyranny and terror. As long as Hezbollah chooses the path of war, Israel has no choice, and Israel has every right to remove this threat and return our citizens to their homes safely. And that's exactly what we're doing.
Well, the U.S. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, said the path to diplomacy is still open.
The objective that Israel has in the first instance in Lebanon is an important and legitimate one. It's creating an environment that's secure enough to enable people to return home. Because remember what happened starting October 8th. Hezbollah started lobbing rockets and missiles into Israel, trying to create another front in the war. And Israel, of course, had to respond to that. And in the process, tens of thousands of people had to evacuate their homes. In northern Israel, villages and homes were destroyed, southern Lebanon. And so we have large populations, both in Israel and in Lebanon, who've been forced from their homes. And it is a legitimate and important objective for Israel to, again, create an environment in which people can get back to their homes. The question is, what's the best way to do that? What is the most effective, sustainable way to do that? We believe, many other countries who joined us in putting out a call for a ceasefire for 21 days believe that the best way to do that is through diplomacy, through a ceasefire and then reaching an agreement.
Earlier tonight on the programme, I spoke to Emma Bartholomew, who's in Beirut.
Until today, the area of Beirut that I'm in at the moment has felt relatively calm. There's been definitely an atmosphere of anticipation and anxiety, and a feeling of deja vu amongst, certainly amongst my Lebanese friends, and the community here. Last week obviously was a huge escalation, and we had several days where the air was gridlocked with the sound of sirens nonstop for hours at a time. But this evening was the first time that I personally felt the blast force, and certainly heard it. So that's slightly changed the atmosphere where I am, because we obviously know that this was a huge bombardment. And so, yeah, I think there's the Lebanese people are very well known for their resilience and their determination to continue in the face of absolutely constant adversity that's been thrown at them, not just through war, but through all sorts of economic and governmental problems over the years. There's always a sense to continue, but I think there's definitely a palpable anxiety right now.
And when that blast that you describe, and at the point it strikes, what happens around that? What do people literally do?
When the blast happened this evening, I was actually completely alone in my room, so I couldn't see other people around me. But I quite quickly went to a place where I knew that there would be other people to see the reaction and see if we should be moving or if there was a sense that we needed to do something different. I am in a hotel at the moment. I would normally be in a more residential area, but I'm staying in a hotel this time. Already people were packing up and leaving. So I think there was a sense that perhaps people had thought that they might be safer in the city and they were now really worried. But things, I mean, humans everywhere adapt, but I think especially here, people are just, they're programmed to just very quickly absorb the shock and then take the next step. And that is a sense that we kind of absorb as visitors if we're lucky enough to be here, which I know that may sound a crazy thing to say at the moment, but this is an incredibly beautiful country with amazing people. And even during the troubles over the last couple of weeks, every single day when I've looked around the city and looked out at the Mediterranean Sea, I've felt lucky to be here. And it's a difficult feeling knowing that I have the option to leave when that is an available option, because it hasn't actually been that available for the last week.
Let's try to get our heads around this more. The senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, former US Ambassador Gina Abercrombie Winstanley, with us this evening. Good evening to you, Gina.
Good evening.
Good evening. These multiple attacks that we've seen over recent days, the airstrikes, the blowing up of pagers, the mobile phones exploding, what capability does Hezbollah still have?
Well, that is a good question. What we do know is that over the last week, it has not been a one-sided exchange. Hezbollah has been sending rockets, has been sending drones to Israel as well. Certainly the Israelis have had the major force of it, but Hezbollah has continued to respond.
Who has the might here when all of the combined forces, the allies, get behind each of the two armies? Who has the upper hand?
Yeah, there's no doubt that it is Israel. They have shown their reach, the breadth, the depth, not only with the pager and walkie-talkie attacks, but also with their ability to strike at the senior leadership of Hezbollah. And they have already, in the last year, taken out most of the senior leadership, as well as that devastating attack on regular soldiers. This afternoon's attack was focused on the Secretary General, the absolute head of Hezbollah, who is a political figure as well, Hassan Nasrallah. And that is a major alteration. I mean, you know, the focus on assassinating the leader of Hezbollah is quite a step to be taken.
And do we know if they succeeded?
We do not know yet. And I think, as your audience may have heard, you know, the United States was very quick to say that we had not participated in that attack, nor had we been apprised of it beforehand. But it is not yet known whether they did indeed get him. Now, they have been very effective over the last several weeks, so we will have to see. But it could well be likely that they have taken out the Secretary General of Hezbollah. We'll see.
Your country has a pivotal role to play, and President Joe Biden has directed the Pentagon to, quote, assess and adjust as necessary U.S. force posture in the Middle East. What does that mean?
Well, there are concerns that the frustrations with the Israeli conflict with Lebanon and beyond might attract attention to U.S. forces in the region, U.S. assets in the region, or U.S. personnel in the region, whether military or otherwise. So the security posture has certainly been increased. We, like many other countries, have been telling citizens to leave Lebanon. There are security advisories for our citizens in Israel as well and other places around the region.
But Gina, this goes well beyond advisories, doesn't it?
This
is a strategic call by Biden. How far can he go? How far can he push the Israelis? And if they don't listen to him, what can he do?
Well, that is the question. He has been giving them excellent advice for the last 11 months. And I do want to stress this. You know, as the Secretary said today, every nation has a responsibility as well as the right to protect its citizens. That is the basic compact made between governments and citizens. However, it does matter how you do it. And we have been advising the Israelis to look for a diplomatic way out, keeping in mind that the vast majority of hostages have been returned via diplomacy, not from a rescue from the IDF. The IDF has killed more hostages than it has rescued, but also that Israel needs long-lasting stability, security, and peace. And the way they are pursuing it is not the way they're going to get it. We heard the Prime Minister say today that Israel is winning. We really have to look at the definition that he must be using. And in my view, I think it is a warped one. Israel has taken horrific economic impact over the war in the last 11 months. Its citizens are being held hostage. Its citizens are, in fact, less safe than they were October 8th because of the Prime Minister's reluctance to pursue a diplomatic avenue forward to end this conflict.
But Netanyahu has responded, hasn't he, in recent hours and said that if they want the war to stop, then Hezbollah needs to surrender. Does he think that there's any chance of them doing that?
You know, that's an interesting question, and I would say he does not. However, we cannot underestimate the impact of the Israeli moves in the last several weeks. They have been very, very critical to Hezbollah. They have not only taken out their ability to communicate.
Oh, I think the line from with Gina has dropped. We'll see if we can get it back. Obviously, if you have an opinion on this tonight, 0808 509-693, and whether we think that a peace deal is further or closer now than ever before. Just while we're waiting to get the line back up with Gina, a heads up that we no doubt this will be in the papers tomorrow, and we'll be looking across all of Saturday mornings. Tomorrow's Saturday, isn't it? Saturday mornings front pages, which we do here on the Nolan Show on a Friday, Saturday and Sunday night at midnight. Well, look, we're having difficulties, obviously, getting that former US ambassador back on the line. So we'll take this opportunity to pause and we'll get you the news. Ah, I think we do have Gina back with us now. Gina, in the brink of time, I was about to go to the news. Evening again, Gina.
Last several weeks, combined with the diplomatic efforts of the United States, France, and others, could very well bring about a ceasefire. They may need to, but it will be one that they are reluctant to carry out.
Well, you say they may be able to bring about a ceasefire. What would they be reluctant to carry out? I didn't catch that, Gina.
Yes, well, because to really get there, they would have to go back to the agreement that they made after 2006, which is to withdraw to, you know, to the other side of the Mitanni River, which is about 30 miles from the border. They would be reluctant to do that because that's what keeps them armed and supported by a broader swath of Lebanese. But that's what would be required to allow Israelis to get back to their homes in the north and Lebanese to get back to their homes in the south.
And is that what's on the table?
Well, certainly that's what everyone is trying to get to. But as I said, it is unlikely without this additional pressure from Israel that Hezbollah would agree to that. And it's unlikely that they will agree even with the additional pressure. But that's where people are trying to get.
Finally, Gina, I see on the news wires that Iran's foreign minister is saying Iran will, quote, be on the side of Lebanon and resistance by all means. Now, obviously, in any war situation, there is a lot of words. How much do you think Iran means it when they say by all means? And how do you interpret that?
Well, they have always said that they would do it at a time of and place of their choosing. And I think any, state that is talking about retaliation, that would be it, that they would say something like that and ensure that whatever they do, it doesn't make the situation worse. Iran has acted like the adult in the room, quite frankly, over this last year. They have communicated with the United States and others what they were going to do when they felt the need to retaliate for an attack by Israel. Much of the escalation has happened from the Israeli side. They have felt the need to do it, but they have been the leaders in escalating it. Iran has tried to keep it at a fairly low level, tit for tat, going back and forth, and we'll have to see what they do now.
Gina, thank you. Let's pause there and get the news from the BBC.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
There have been warm tributes to Dame Maggie Smith, who's died at the age of 89. She was best known for her roles in the Harry Potter films and in Downton Abbey, and won two Oscars during a career that spanned seven decades. Hugh Bonneville, who also starred in Downton Abbey, said Dame Maggie was a true legend of her generation. Israel says it's bombed what it called Hezbollah's central headquarters in Beirut. The Lebanese health ministry said the attack killed at least two people and injured 76 others. The attack came shortly after the Israeli prime minister addressed the UN General Assembly in New York. And two boys have been sentenced to life with a minimum term of 8.5 years for murdering a teenager with a machete. The pair, who cannot be named, were just 12 when they attacked Sean Caesarhigh in a park in Wolverhampton in November last year. In sport, England's cricketers have levelled up their one-day international series against Australia at 2-2 with a huge 186-run victory in a rain-affected match at Lord's. Eleanor Aldroyd reports.
After two heavy defeats in the first two games of the series, a stunning performance with bat and ball gave England a massive win by 186 runs. A delayed start, overs reduced to 39 aside after morning rain. Harry Brook with 87 and Ben Duckett 63 gave England a solid foundation. But Liam Livingston broke the Lord's ODI records for fastest 50 off 25 balls and most runs in an over, 28 off Mitchell Stark's final over, to set Australia a target of 313. They made a decent start. They were 68 without loss, then collapsed to 96 for six, thanks to the pace of Archer and Kaas and the accuracy of Potts. Australia all out for 126, and the teams go to Bristol with all to play for on Sunday.
In rugby league, Lee Leopards produced a spirited performance to win 14-6 away at Salford. That books their place in the Super League semi-finals. Newly promoted Crystal Palace endured another tough night in the Women's Super League. They were humbled 7-0 at Selhurst Park by the reigning champions Chelsea. In the Championship, Plymouth edged out Luton 3-1 at Home Park. Tranmere and Salford City drew 0-0 in League 2. In Rugby Union's Premiership, Christian Wade scored a hat-trick as Gloucester beat Bristol 44-41, while in the United Rugby Championship, Leinster recorded a 34-6 bonus point win over Dragons, and Glasgow ran in six tries as they thrashed Benetton 42-10.
On Radio 4, the more you listen, the more you see.
We're living under more tyranny today than our founding fathers did in 1775.
A US presidential election is looming, but underneath, conspiracy culture rears its head once again. And nothing is as it seems.
All those things that we had feared our whole lives was coming true.
Burn the house down and start over. That seems to be the way.
It's America through the looking glass. Join me, Gabriel Gatehouse, as the coming storm continues. Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We feel totally betrayed.
Welcome to Murrayfield.
I listen to you guys all the time.
Stephen Nolan.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Right, let's head over to the United States, where five condemned men in five states have been executed over 6 days. In Alabama, officials carried out the second execution in the U.S., using the controversial method of nitrogen gas, an experimental technique for humans that veterinarians have deemed unacceptable in the US and Europe for the euthanasia of most animals. Robin Maher is the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center. It's a non-profit organization serving the media and the public with analysis and information on issues concerning the death penalty. Robin, good evening.
Good evening.
Tell us what happened this week.
Well, this week we saw an unprecedented number of executions across the United States. We had five executions in just a week's time, and it has been decades since we've seen so many executions in just a short period of time. And these cases were troubling, each of them in their own way. One in Missouri has really prompted widespread outrage because of the serious issues of innocence in his case. And the unwillingness of elected officials in that state to set aside his execution until those concerns could be satisfied.
But at the end of the day, this is these are democratically supported decisions, aren't they, state to state?
Well, it's hard to say that with any kind of certainty. I mean, the elected officials in those states that are making these decisions were certainly put there by the voters in those states. But we're not seeing any evidence of growing public support for more executions. And in many of these cases, we're seeing real public opposition. So I think there's a real disconnect between what the elected officials in many of these states are doing, the decisions they're making, and what the American public really wants to see.
What does a death using nitrogen gas look like?
Well, it looks pretty ghastly from all accounts. This is the second execution with nitrogen gas that Alabama has used this year. The first was in January. Mr. Kenny Smith was executed then. Mr. Alan Miller was executed last night, also using nitrogen gas. This is an experimental procedure. Before Alabama chose to use it this year, no other state had used it. In fact, we're not aware that anywhere in the world that nitrogen gas had been used in an execution. And the media reports unfortunately confirm what we saw earlier this year, which is that the prisoner appeared to be gasping and struggling against his restraints and suffering some distress and pain. Of course, we don't know the full story there because Mr. Miller is dead. He can't tell us what he experienced, but the media reports are pretty graphic and disturbing.
And yet the authorities give a different version of the effectiveness of nitrogen gas, don't they?
They certainly do. I mean, it is really a very different story. They have maintained with both of these executions that they've gone according to plan, but that's not what the media witnesses say. That's not what the other witnesses who observe the execution say. And it's, I think, unfortunately, you know, a sort of a false fact, a fake news kind of situation where Alabama officials continue to double down on their assertion that this is a safe and peaceful way to execute people in defiance of all the evidence to the contrary.
What brought you into this nonprofit organization, Robin?
Well, I've been involved with the death penalty for a number of years. I worked as a capital defender for many years, and I joined the Death Penalty Information Center about a year and a half ago as an executive director. I think we have an important function, which is to bring real truth and data and analysis to the conversation about the death penalty. It's often an emotional subject. We want to make sure people understand exactly what we're talking about when we talk about using the death penalty today in the United States.
What other methods are used?
Well, lethal injection remains the most prominent method of execution that's used. Unfortunately, we're seeing states experimenting with other methods or bringing back old methods. The state of South Carolina, which just executed someone last Friday night using lethal injection, also authorized the use of the electric chair and the firing squad. So we're seeing old methods that are being reinvigorated for use. That's partly because some of the drugs that have been traditionally used in lethal injection cocktails have become harder to obtain or very expensive. So some states are turning to different methods of execution as a consequence.
And why do you think that is, that this is not just a pocket of a small number of states? Why do you think, obviously you're in opposition to this, but there is significant support for this, and presumably that's because people are mindful of these perpetrators' victims and how callous they were and how much disregard they had for human life and human suffering?
Well, first, Stephen, we don't take a position on the death penalty. DPI is not an advocacy organization. We are an information center. And so we're not taking a position pro or con with the death penalty. But we do think it's important for people to understand the problems that we see in the death penalty. And, of course, there are many of them. You know, the death penalty in the United States is increasingly isolated in just a handful of states. And a bare majority of people, just 53% of the American public, still support using the death penalty. So it's a very close call for
most Americans. But that is still a majority.
It is a slim majority, but what I think is important to know as well is that many victims' family members have said they do not wish to support the death penalty, even for the person who took their loved one from them in a violent episode, because they recognize that the death penalty is not bringing them the closure they were promised, and because it doesn't do anything except create another grieving family. So we have many victims' family members who have become outspoken about turning away from use of the death penalty, like much of the rest of the country.
Tell us about Marcellus Williams in Missouri, because there was widespread commentary about that across your country. What happened?
Well, Mr. Williams' case did become quite controversial. He maintained his innocence for the entirety of his time behind prison bars, and there was a great deal of evidence that suggested he was, in fact, innocent. There was no evidence that tied him to the crime. The witnesses that testified against him were incentivized, i.e. rewarded for their testimony. And so the sitting prosecutor, the same office that had prosecuted Mr. Williams and sought his death sentence, agreed that the office had not been fair in prosecuting him. They confessed error, constitutional error, and agreed with the defense counsel that Mr. Williams should get a new trial. Unfortunately, other elected officials in the state of Missouri, the attorney general and the governor, disagreed with that agreement, and they pushed for his continued execution. So for many years, the innocence of Mr. Williams has been at issue. I think it struck a chord and resonated with quite a number of people around the country. And, of course, there were some unfortunate allegations of racism in his case as well, that also troubled people and reminded them that this is a longstanding concern in the use of the death penalty.
How did Kamala Harris and Donald Trump differ towards the death penalty?
Well, Vice President Harris has not made any statements about the death penalty. President Trump, of course, presided over 13 executions, federal executions, during his term in office. And he has promised to use the federal death penalty when, if and when he returns to office. Remember, of course, the United States, each of the states has their own death penalty system. They are sovereign in their ability to make decisions about who is selected for death and if they are going to face a death sentence or an execution. And the president of the United States only has oversight over the federal death row. And there are just 40 people on the federal death row currently. So it's really still up to the states, and that's where I think voters are increasingly making their opinions known, and elected officials are paying attention to the changing opinion and attitudes about the death penalty.
Just one final question, Robin. Are there many people who are incarcerated? What is the split, the percentage split, between those people who are incarcerated for life as to whether they want to die or not, whether they want to be given the death penalty?
Well, there are a few people, of course, with severe mental illness who commit crimes and then ask to be executed. People with severe mental illness who become suicidal after, you know, they have been arrested and charged with a capital crime.
It surely wouldn't be just people with mental illness. There must be people who, rather than spend 20, 30, 40 years in a tiny cell, simply want to die.
Well, you're 100% right. Well, it's not a get out. It is an answer to the extremely difficult conditions of being on death row in isolation for that long a period of time. But remember that the law requires that we do a careful examination of both the crime and the individual. That the people for whom we reserve the death penalty are the people that juries decide are especially worthy of that punishment, meaning they understand their story, their life experiences. And people with severe mental illness, generally speaking, are not among those who we consider to be the most culpable and therefore the most deserving of the death penalty. But certainly you're right. There are people who have suicidal intentions who do wish to be sentenced to death. They are far in the minority of those who face a possible death sentence.
It's really interesting territory, Robin. Thank you very much for speaking to us tonight. Thank you. 0808-5909-693. If you've got a view on that, next people with ADHD say they're still struggling to get hold of their medication. It comes a year on from when the shortage started, and the government says an increased global demand caused the problem. Lorelei Mathias is author, comedian, creator of the online comedy show Life in ADHD. Good evening.
Good evening. Hello there.
How did the shortage? Hiya. How did the shortage affect you? What happened?
Well, it's a game of Chinese whispers every month, really, with not knowing between my pharmacy and GP who's got what in stock. My main gripe with it all is that it's already too hard to get your medication, but with a shortage, it's beyond Herculean. So it's a case of it depends what people are looking for, but I need methylphenidate, and the supplies are always up and down of that. So I generally try to ration what I have got, just because I don't know that I'll definitely get each month the amount that I need. So, and also sharing with friends, and just in regular contact with friends who are on similar things. And actually today an article was on BBC talking about the struggles that my friends and I have been having, and as a result, people have been sending messages to my Instagram saying, I've got spares because I've titrated onto a different thing. So if you need anyone needs Elvance, I've got some, which is really lovely. People have been now messaging to try and help get what they need.
Why is there a shortage? What's going on?
It's a very long-winded answer. Depends how long you've got, really. But I think partly it's to do with the manufacturers switching from what was once a having lots of things in stock model to a print on demand model. So now it's you have to order it in each time, which just doesn't work for anyone. It makes the process, which is already maddeningly convoluted, even more so. So now I think of it as a part-time job to get my medication. There's so many stages of admin involved. So that's why we call it the admin zone, and wrote a sketch parodying it. But I think the reason the demand has gone up is that a lot more people have been diagnosed, but I think I have a lot to say on that matter. But I don't want to kind of go on off on a tangent, which is a classic ADD thing to do. But my concern is that the more people are talking about ADHD, the more people think they have it. And that has actually diluted and distracted from the really the serious people that have it to a debilitating degree, which I would class myself in that category, along with a lot of good friends of mine who can't leave the house because they have it so bad. And they can't entertain the idea of getting medication now because it's so difficult anyway, that only the people that slightly have ADHD or have maybe burnt their brain using smartphones a little too much and might not need it as badly as the ones that really, really can't actually do the processes involved.
Well, if they don't need it, why do you think they're being prescribed it?
I mean, it's not for me to judge what anyone does and doesn't need, but my concern is I know there's people that need it very badly and can't get it. And the problem isn't the problem they can't get it is the system's broken. We need to be building a ramp to help people that have access problems, but we're not because they're invisible disabilities. But the system is designed for neurotypical people that can do exec functioning and have good temporal awareness and can make reminders and appointments. So the people that are really struggling with ADHD can't get that medication. Do you see what I mean? But I think there might be people that need it, but it's not for me to judge. But I think everyone that is struggling should be given what they need to help them. But I think the system needs to change to enable the people that really, really need it to be able to access it.
How has it affected your life so far?
What the supply?
ADHD.
ADHD
itself.
I'd say it's the making of me and the breaking of me. it was the breaking of me and then the making of me. I was always told, I always felt like there was something slightly not functioning properly with my brain all through my 20s. But I was very successful and I had books published at 25 and got a first. And so all my doctors always said, oh, you know, you've just got anxiety. There's nothing wrong with you. You can't have ADHD. But as I got older and the more experiences I had, the more stimulus I had, the more million projects I made, it's become obvious that, you know, it was something else. And then I've then made comedy about it and found a way to laugh at it, and that's been, like I say, the making of me. But it's no picnic. It's not a quirk. It's a very serious challenge daily.
What are the symptoms of it? What were the symptoms of it for you growing up,
I find it very hard to concentrate and listen, but it's more a case of my brain is always thinking of a million other things than what it should be thinking of. Like, I mean, my gift is that I constantly think of metaphors for what it feels like. So it's like, instead of having a prefrontal cortex at the front of my brain organizing everything, I've got a prefrontal vortex. So everything's just kind of more chaotic inside. And I lose things a lot because of that, because I'm not always concentrating exactly on what I'm holding. So I drop things or I lose things. I'm slightly dyspraxic, I think, as well. So I actually lose a lot of money every year on replacing lost items, and I call it Lost Men. I've made a dictionary in my web series, Life in ADHD. It's called the ADHD Dictionary. So one of the words is Lost Men, because I spend so much money all the time just replacing my lost things. And that's where I would say a real test of, you know, how much do you really spend on replacing lost items if you've not got ADD? You know, for some of us, it's very expensive. I'd say that's the worst thing, really, is losing things and temporal awareness. And
well,
just
things that you're in your hand and you put them down, or expensive things,
yeah.
Or what?
Oh,
what
yeah,
do you mean?
I wouldn't entertain the idea of having earpods, for example. Like, there's no way I could do that. So instead I have cables that I wear that get tangled up, and every time I take my, phone and anything up, you know, when I arrive somewhere, it takes me 5 minutes to untangle. And then I've turned that into clowning and done a sketch called Russian Doll, which, you know, has won some awards. But that's how the only way I've been able to cope with all the things that I have is to turn it into comedy, because it is a hilarious condition when managed, but it's also very horrific. But yeah, losing things, I will drop things, but mostly I'll put something down. Unless it's tied to me, I'll put something down all the time and then forget to pick it up again. So I'll get home and go, oh, I had a water bottle. Where did that go? Oh, that's there. Okay, I'll just put some emails out. Where did I go today? Who, you know, there's a lot of admin involved in the retracing of steps. So I mean, people have said it sounds like dementia. And I would say that's exactly what I can't speak to having dementia, because I don't know exactly. But I know that there's the cold water swimming can help dementia, because it's a vagus nerve issue. And that's why I try and do a lot of cold water swimming, because I can feel my brain sharpen. I can feel it make me more aware.
Do you think, Lorelei, that you've been kind of inferring tonight that too many people are being diagnosed with it, and that there are some people who don't deserve the diagnosis. Is that fair?
So no. I would say that there's more people now empathizing with it, which is great. People need to empathize with what the symptoms are. But what I'm concerned about is that the system's broken. So it's too hard. Like the way that you get your medication, you are required to do a number of steps that actually need you to have brilliant exec functioning, amazing memory, amazing temporal awareness, amazing, all the things that, you know, filling in forms, making appointments, which you can't do if you've got it very severely. So I'm not saying no one, you know, some people shouldn't get medication. If they think they need it and it can help them, then that's great. But what I'm saying is, because there's that increase in number, the people that have got it very severely that are still getting, like my best friend Lauren, has a slightly more inattentive version. I'm more over focused ADD. So I'm constantly alert. And I'm constantly doing things. But like, I think she can't get it. She's just been spewed out of the admin zone herself because she didn't see a reminder. So they've discharged her. So she was about to start titration and she can't. So it's for people like
that.
Do
you think people could have it for their entire life or a large part of their life and not know they have it?
Well, like I'm listening
to you tonight, right?
Yeah.
I'm listening to you tonight. And I was in a stage in my 20s where I couldn't keep a passport. So every time I went in, and I knew it was an important document, and I lost my passport that often that they called me to the side and they said, if I lost one more, I would be on some type of elevated security risk.
Oh my goodness.
And I thought I think I lost 7 passports in about 2 years.
Wow.
And it was extraordinary because I couldn't understand. I knew it was an important document. I would go in and get it and then I would lose it. And I would lose things all the time. Important stuff. I would lose car keys. I would lose wallets. I would lose all of that. Now, that's maybe me just being reckless and irresponsible and all that comes with it.
I think the test is your life unmanageable? Are you on the floor of a supermarket crying and with overwhelm and indecision paralysis because you can't decide which type of hummus to buy? Have you had a lot of meltdowns where you're like, I just feel like I'm a square peg in a round hole and I can't walk life anymore. Like that, something's not right here. It's not anxiety. It's not depression. I'm not depressed. I'm extremely ambitious. I'm extremely high functioning. I've achieved a lot, but,
I don't know if I'm high functioning. That's definitely ruled out.
Well, this is it. Like you have a very sharp, rapier sharp, lightning fast brain that can achieve so much, but it just doesn't function in the way that neurotypical world is designed for. But no, it's I think that when people lose things, my brother and my friends will sit there going, I've lost my wallet, and I'll sit there and I'll count to 5 and I'll say, no, you haven't. There it is. Because I know that they are feeling a little bit of what it is to lose things. And everyone feels a little bit of what it is to have ADD. They know they've got 12 tabs open at once. Oh, that's a bit overwhelming. If you've got ADD, you've got 50,000 tabs open. Rory Bremner and I, we've designed a thing called Tab Trumps, which is a game. You can choose at one time how many have you got. And we did it to him, and he had like 312 on just one browser. You know, that's the kind of thing. It's dialed up to the max. The passport thing is sobering. I think, you know, maybe you were distracted a lot, or you weren't eating enough, or you're tired. Because in those circumstances, you feel the low functioning, except functioning. Sorry.
Emily, no, it's okay. Emily Tilly was due to talk about something else. Comedian, long time hospitality worker. No, it's fine because Emily, you've got ADHD as well, right?
I do indeed. You seem to be surrounded by ADHD comics at this point. this is great.
And do you recognise what Lorelai is saying? Was it the same for you?
Yeah, big time. I think one of the things that they really look at when they go into diagnosis is how it affected you when you were younger. And I think one thing that we have to keep in mind is that when it's in... like women, for example, it presents totally differently to how it presents in men, to how it presents in those who are non-binary, so on and so forth. I think it's really important to keep in mind that ADHD is such a spectrum. You know, it is such a spectrum, and everyone will come into that spectrum at some point. We will all have traits within that spectrum. But it's, I know for me, I was, and this is something they say is like, if you're intelligent, you coast through school, because although you're intelligent and you struggle with the organizational things, you'll do just enough whilst you're in secondary school to be able to pass and get through. What actually happens is you'll notice that people, when they get into college, when they get into university, they really struggle with being able to organize themselves and so on and so forth. Like, it really shows within childhood. And I remember being younger and going, there's something there. There is something there which is really, like, it's making me struggle, and I'm finding myself so frustrated in my own brain. And people didn't believe me. People didn't believe me. And whether it was because there was a lack of education around the time, so on and so forth, like, seeing how it affected my childhood and how I grew up and how I have arguably, like, some level of educational trauma from it, from not being believed and being left in the dark without the support that I needed, was a real struggle, you know. And we can speak about losing things and so on and so forth, but it's so multifaceted and it presents so differently in so many people that we will all be on that spectrum, but not everyone will fit into the category. Each person will present even slightly differently.
Does it make you hyper?
Oh, can you tell I'm talking really fast right now? I'm currently at my work walking around the office because I'm not able to sit still. I have moments where I feel like real energy surges and I get like up and I'm bouncing and I'm moving and then I crash really hard. It's quite a constant thing, the constant ups and the downs and the confusion. And it's a constant need for balance, which I know we talk about medication, which is what the medication is supposed to bring when it's available.
You're on to talk about queuing up for a pint or something, Emily. Yeah. But I think this is a lot more interesting if you're cool with it.
Talking to you about this.
I used to go when I was in my early 20s. I'm 51 now. I'm an old man now. But when I was in my early 20s, I used to go to a summer camp in America, where there were all these American kids would come into the summer camp, and there were counselors from around the world. Why am I saying this? Because lots of these American kids were diagnosed to have ADHD, and the parents, when they were going to the summer camp, would take them off their medication. Ritalin, I remember it was called. And the reason I ask you, does it make you hyper? These kids off their medication would be bouncing off the wall hyper. And I remember this thinking, the parents are medicating these children and then taking them off, obviously, that necessary medication in the summer. So without medication, do some people with ADHD, Emily, is it exhausting?
So one thing I want to point out with that is that there is a lot to